This is a London Undone podcast. My name is Catherine Cartwright. These podcasts give you an audible insight into some curious places around London. This series focuses on the historic and at times peculiar City of London churches, their histories, features, associations, and their spiritual lives. This week we find ourselves back on Cornhill, this time at the Church of St Michael, where Jill Finch explained its story, Steve Welsh its features, and Alex Epps showed off its many stained glass windows. We're standing at the back, the south side of St Michael Cornhill in the garden, which would once have been a graveyard, looking at the rather dirty walls of St Michael Cornhill. They definitely need a clean. And I'm talking to Jill, and you're going to tell me a bit about the history of the church.
So, St Michael, it started off as a medieval parish city church, and like so many of our city churches, I'm sure you hear this over and over again, started off with Saxon, we never see much of that, and then we usually know about the medieval, the Norman church. The name Cornhill is first mentioned in about the 12th century, and it is the street where the corn market was. So, the streets kind of did what they said on the can. And, of course, Cornhill is one of the highest points in the city, and the other one is Ludgate Hill. So you've got St Paul's over on Ludgate Hill and St Peter over here on Cornhill, which is rather synchronous, which is rather nice. And one of its more famous parishioners was a man called John Stowe, who wrote the Survey of London. He quite literally walked around London, writing down every single thing that he saw. And he describes it as a fair and beautiful church, with a cloister, lodgings for choristers, a pulpit cross where sermons were preached. And it just gives you a whole different idea about it. It's quite kind of contained in now, but you imagine it, with a lot more space around it. It didn't get badly damaged in the Great Fire, but the tower, which was a 15th century tower, was unstable, needed to be built again. Now, rebuilding of this church was once attributed to Wren. It's clumped in with the Wren churches.
Yeah.
But there are very, very good church records at this parish, and they say that the mason and the architect was called Nicholas Young. And the church wasn't built with coal tax money, so they had to go then to Christopher Wren to get recompense, because he held the purse strings of the coal tax money. So the notes of meetings in the records talk about dinner with Mr. Wren, meeting with Mr. Wren, a gift of silver for Mr. Wren. They're already getting a bit desperate by this time to get their money back. So I think Wren's name crept into the record, and that's where some of the confusion comes.
How would you describe the outside, other than dirty?
This is actually nicer, isn't it, than the other side?
Well, it's very ornamental, isn't it? It's still, I think, very beautiful on this side.
Yeah, and but on the other side, it's very plain.
It's very plain.
And that makes it seem obvious that Wren, he had this attitude that he didn't spend money and he didn't make things pretty if something was going to be built right up next to it and there wasn't any point.
It's like sweeping the dirt under the carpet, isn't it?
It's like painting round your cupboards in your bedroom. Yeah. I mean, the tower, to me, is Gothic. Yeah. And also, it's got a feeling of almost Baroque as well. Hawksmoor very possibly did the top bit of the tower.
Austere,
yes.
Isn't it?
And
even though it's decorative, it's austere.
And that was the thing, that was a big difference between Hawksmoor and Wren. I mean, Hawksmoor learned everything from Wren, but he went a completely different pathway, because Wren was much, much lighter, much more gentle. Things were
delicate.
Yes. Hawksmoor was very powerful.
Yeah. It's more military and masculine.
It is, yes. It is masculine, definitely.
And yet it is, I see this as a more masculine version of St Mary, Older Mary.
Yes.
Because it's got the four turrets on the corners.
Yeah.
But this has a more military feel to it. And just looking now, and as you were talking about it, I hadn't noticed before, that there are lots of heads dotted around on this, around the edges.
Yes, almost like the old kind of gargoyles or hunky punks, they call them in Somerset. Have these rather strange faces looking down.
Yeah,
it's a good word, isn't it? But again, you see, I mean, if you look at the bottom half and you think that maybe William Dickinson was involved in this, Those arched windows and the almost louvered window that you can see, that is incredibly Wren. So that's kind of looking at somebody who is in Wren's office, perhaps doing something that Wren's gone, oh yeah, put some of those windows in or something.
Whenever I talk to anyone about the churches and the building of them, everybody without fail sort of de-romanticises it and just like, it's just a big job, let's get it done.
It is, and I think one of the reasons that, you know, the confusion arises is because at that point they never imagined people like us would be standing here 300 and something years later unpicking every little bit of their building. And so, you know, Wren and Hawksmoor or Wren and Hook might have come and looked at a building, and Wren might have gone, oh, you know, let's do this here and let's have these kind of windows, and the other one's writing things down, making quick sketches, but nobody signed it and said, this is my work, this is me. And yeah, de-romanticising is a wonderful description of it, I think, because, you know, it was a business.
Moving around to the north side of the church where the main door now stands, just set back from Cornhill, Jill, joined by church watcher Steve and Alex, who runs Art in the City, explained the later 19th century additions to the church.
By the 1850s, the Drapers' Company fund a very lavish embellishment scheme with George Gilbert Scott. So this is where you get the 19th century beautification, all the additions. And Scott demolished a house next to the tower and he replaced it with the elaborate porch. It's decorated with carving by a man named John Burney Phillip, and the angels that surround everything are also by the same man.
To the right of the door as you come in, there is... Tell me what we're looking at.
It's St Michael as a war memorial, and we've got the little children on one side and then these sort of leopard type creatures on the other, and it's the idea of new life overcoming the war and the loss.
That was in 1920 by a fellow called Richard Goulden, again of St Michael, vanquishing war, which is everybody fighting down below.
And here you can see the Battle of Heaven going on in the tympanum. It's so beautiful, and all the little angels' heads peeking out all the way round.
You're not wrong about the angels, and they're everywhere. When I start looking, you sort of first thing you think, oh, it's floral decoration, but actually no, there are so many little heads peeking out everywhere.
Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, isn't that extraordinary?
Well, I think the thing is, as you're walking down Cornhill or walking up Cornhill, it's almost hidden away. You come across it without even realising. And it's a very narrow street, and you're standing on the other side of the road trying not to bump into people or people bump into you, because it's mesmerising when you actually stand in front of it and look at it.
So we're going up the stairs. So we're right in the porch of the church. To the right of the door as you come in, there's a little niche. There's a little niche, and hiding behind that niche is a tiny window.
St Michael defeating the fallen, and just it's that gaping mouth of the dragon.
Almost looks like a tyrannosaurus.
And all the flame. Yeah, totally. And the chains coming down from his hands. It's just so delightful. So many people miss it. And it's my little friend up there.
Let's go in.
We all have doors.
Oh, and suddenly it's quiet.
It's one of the great churches, I think, for grandeur and quietness when coming off a city street. A lot of people obviously just come in to have a quick look round, but it's again one of those churches where people do actually get into a pew and just sit there for 5-10 minutes and just look around and contemplate and etc. Peace and quiet. Yeah.
Can you describe what it looks like?
Very unusual. This pelican, in fact, was done by a fellow called Joseph Gaisley.
And the pelican essentially stands where the original door would have been.
Yes, that would have been the door, yes. They were going to get rid of that pelican when the church was being Victorianised. But the rector had a little girl who was only about 6 or 7, and she begged the workman to keep it.
She liked
it. The story goes she gave him 1/2 crown, and it's been here ever since.
How funny. So this is very old. It predates the Victorian renovations.
Not that old. I think it's 1770. But
so we've come into a big space. The church has like got a main sort of nave and then 2 aisles on either side, and the arches that mark out where the aisles are have got rounded tops. It doesn't have that Gothic point, but yet it still feels very Victorian.
It does. And one of the glories of the church, and there's a lot of hostility towards Victorian stuff, but it's down here. But William Gibbs Rogers carved all these. Yeah. Now, they're all totally individual. Every single one is different.
So he's in these sort of the pew ends, is that the right way of describing these carved figures that you yep. mentioned, all individual? He's carved onto the aisle side of them, these crests.
Well, just to take you out and show you three, for example, if we move over to the south aisle over here, this follows a famous painting by somebody he knew called Holman Hunt, called yeah. The Scapegoat. There's a lot of other carvings depicting from the Bible, and the main ones you've got down here, that's the diocese of the Bishop of London. This was Queen Victoria, and as you see, you've got the royal motto. If you look down there, you've got V for Victoria. And if you look inside, the carving is just as good, different from all the rest. So it really is an absolute work of art.
It's actually written a V-I-C-T.
Yeah, Victoria.
O-R-I-A.
So here, for example, we've got the Merchant Tailors. They've got a lot of links with the church. So you've got the drapers here.
Okay. So there are several livery companies associated with the church.
Yes.
The drapers aren't the only ones.
But they are the main ones because they've had responsibility, if you like, for nominating. It has to go, obviously, the Bishop of London and things like
yeah.
that. But they sort of nominate who they'd like to come into the church to be the new rector.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they've had that since 1503. Now, the altar, or the reederos, which is behind there, used to be a wooden one. Scott put this Italianate Derbyshire marble, or pinky marble bit in. Although Scott put a lot in the 1930s, they were redecorated and things happened.
In previous occasions when I've come in here, it seemed darker. Today it seems a little bit lighter. The windows are only on the one side. They're not on the side of Cornhill.
It certainly can be gloomy.
Yeah. No. Tell me about the stained glass windows in here. What is special about them?
What's wonderful about these windows is this is the best example of Victorian Gothic in the city. And it's by one of the most prolific firm of designers called Clayton Bell. And this was their first, I think, biggest commission. And there is really not that many churches up and down the country that don't have at least one Clayton Bell window in them. I think probably about 5 years after this church, and this is sort of 1860, I think, they then go on, it's almost like a factory, and they're really kind of leading the way up until the First World War, when everything starts to change. But what they're doing is, I think, if you know any medieval glass, you can see that they're referencing that wonderful glowing use of colour and storytelling. The window here at the east end is circular, but it's this wonderful, warm, glowing window where you can see the figure of Christ with his arms outstretched. It's as if he's floating out into the congregation, I always feel. He's got these rejoicing angels playing different instruments all the way around him. There's the wonderful rainbow-like coloured bands emanating behind the figure. And if you look with binoculars, you can see there's little circles, little medallions, and each one of those have got cherubs' heads in them. That interlocking pattern of flowers all the way around. It's so intricate. It's a sort of a design that just keeps on building and is very typical of these two's work. They were introduced to each other by Gilbert Scott, who was responsible for this church, and I think Bell was Scott's assistant. And Clayton was already an artist in his own right, and he was associated with the Pre-Raphaelite artists. I think he was quite friendly with Rossetti. But if you look at the contrast of the east end to the west end, can you see that's where we get that elongated window, much more of a shape that we'd associate with the Gothic, and that wonderful blue. I mean, these windows apparently were very well received at the time, but there is some press cutting that I've read where that blue's described as glaring, which is quite funny, really, but it just shows how different it must have been, because it is this real explosion of colour after the other Victorian glass that's much kind of dimmer and duller. So notice the border glowing with colour and all of the flowers
beneath where Mary Magdalene is hugging onto that green cross.
You mentioned Mary Magdalene.
Yes.
This is the crucifixion it's
the
showing.
Crucifixion, and she's kneeling at the base of the crucifix, and you can see next to her her pot of oil. Can you see that? Which she would said to have anointed Christ's feet. And the chorus of angels exploding above the crucifix.
When I first looked at it, I didn't notice they were angels. It looks like a pattern.
But if you look at these windows that are lining the side of the church, can you see that they have clear glass around them? Now, originally, they would have had the same kind of heavily patterned borders, but they were taken out, I think, in the 30s to allow more light into the church. And it's a great shame because it's really compromised the overall design of the windows. They're telling the story of the life of Christ chronologically, and have beautiful details, the colours and the wings and the feathers of the angels and the drapery. And you can see how they're colour-coded as well, which gives you an idea of how the borders would have been. There's yellow, blue, pink and so on. There's some sensational angels that echo all the golden angels that line the interior of this church anyway.
You've made such a clear point on all the windows about the many colours that Clayton and Bell have used. It is extraordinary how many colours there are. I'm trying to visualise this church without all of this stained glass, which... Does it dominate?
It's very vibrant, but I feel that it's very inclusive. It's telling the stories, and that's what it's meant, you know, to be doing. So I think the fact that it's glowing with life makes it easier to relate to.
Yeah.
And I think if you imagine this church as highly decorated, it puts a different spin on how the glass works with it. You know, you were raising that point of, is it dominating too much? But if you think of how patterned the walls were and all that stenciling, it's a very different kind of vision, isn't it?
So just to let the listeners know, the churches we're sitting in it today, you've described the fine detail of the windows, but the walls are painted white. However, previously, when the restoration took place,
highly decorated and stenciled and patterned, and so it's floor, windows, you know, everything comes together as a complete vision in that way.
Shame it's not here, actually.
It is a shame, but on the other hand, it has this beautiful serenity in here. It still has a wonderful feeling to it, and all those angels, probably more angels than any other church.